Now, I gather from Stacy that you want to do 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, saving three for each one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, there are several issues that are common, and then there's some issues that are independent. How are you going to handle the clock hasn't started yet, so this is just housekeeping. How are you going to handle the common issues?
So what we've decided is I would address the first two common issues in the brief, A and B, regarding the multiple conspiracies. And then my colleague, Mr. Ayers, is going to address the second two issues of the joint briefing. Ms. Elliott will be addressing her client's, appellant Carmen's issues regarding, the CC issues that are separate. I'm going to rest on the brief for my client, Mr. Tones, unless this court has any questions for me. And I believe that in the 10 minutes, Mr. Ayers is also going to be addressing some issues regarding Mr. Blackman.
A brief mention of Mr. Blackman's issues, Your Honor.
Okay. I think I've got it. Go ahead.
Took us a while to figure that out, too. So, to begin with, I think the cornerstone of the whole case boils down to whether or not the government was able to prove a single overarching conspiracy. And we would submit to the court they were unable to do it. No single enterprise was ever proven in this case. And we would submit because one didn't exist. The government failed to show that there was any common purpose or single enterprise that linked everybody within this indictment. It did not show a meeting of the minds. There was association. But obviously that's not enough to prove conspiracy. And the circumstances have to lead to an inference that there was some form of overall agreement. Again, that wasn't shown. And then they would have to show that each of the defendants had a reason to know the scope of the conspiracy and to believe that their benefits derived from the conspiracy, rested with the success of the entire enterprise. Again, none of these things were shown in the evidence. What was shown was that there was a group of people, the majority of the people charged in the indictment. The commonality was they grew up in the same neighborhood in Compton that was between 83rd Street and Normandy, so it follows that many of them were A-Tray gangster Crips, members of that gang, where they were friends of those individuals. That was the commonality. The other commonality is that many of them went to Spokane in order to sell drugs for profit. Again, that does not create an entire enterprise of all these individuals that were indicted.
Although it's very strange that you would have everybody either a member of a gang or affiliated in some way with the same gang from the same area in Compton that all decide to vacation in Spokane.
Well, they decide to vacation in Spokane at different times. And again, I would use an analogy of airlines. You've got all these different airlines, and one of the airlines decides, hey, I'm going to start charging baggage fees for my passengers. I'm going to make $30 a head every time a passenger boards the plane. Delta starts it. Then American says, that's a great idea. I'm going to do the same thing. Another airline, great idea. I'm going to do the same thing. There's a profit to be made, and it doesn't mean they all conspired together. It means that somebody saw somebody making money and decided to do the same thing. Again, they're associates. And I think one of the testimonies of one of the government's witnesses, I think it was Madison, said as soon as one of the co-defendants, Miles, one of his couriers was busted at the airport with a lot of money, everybody realized, wow, I mean, everybody's talking. They're all friends with each other, friends from the neighborhood, talking about it, and everybody realizes this is, something to be gained by going there. But again, what happened in the trial, so we would submit there was no proof of an overall enterprise, but what happened at trial, and this ties into the issue relating to the government's use of law enforcement as dual testimony as experts, is that they mischaracterized the evidence from the beginning all the way through. They had Agent Sullivan get on the stand right out of the gates and call this a DTO, a drug trafficking organization, which immediately lent the air that this is one conspiracy. Then they mislabeled all the individuals that had been indicted by saying if one individual secured their own source, sold their own pills, kept their own money, the government labeled that individual in the trial as a manager, but within the pyramid. So they said Carmen is the head of the pyramid and everybody else is in the hierarchy in this pyramid, which was a complete mischaracterization of the evidence.
Counsel, you have your two first issues. One deals with the sufficiency of the conspiracy, which is I think what you're
yes.
dealing with now. let's suppose that I were, for just hypothetically, that I were persuaded that there was sufficient evidence on which one could find one conspiracy. I am concerned, however, with the district court's limitation on not allowing you to argue that these were interlacing conspiracies rather than one conspiracy because of the fact that you had 55 defendants who had already pled guilty to conspiracy. So would you address
yes.
the jury instruction question?
I believe Mr. Ayers will address that jury instruction question.
Okay, Mr. Erskine is going to address it. That's fine.
Yes, but I can speak to that as far as not permitting the defense to argue its defense, that it is a defense to a single conspiracy charge, that there were, in fact, multiple conspiracies. And in this case, although the instruction was given, and Mr. Ayers will discuss that further, it really was form over substance because the defense was not allowed to argue and show the jury, you know, and untangle the words of Agent Sullivan, that in fact these were separate conspiracies and there was no overall. And the government argued they shouldn't be allowed to do that because these other people pled guilty, but as this court is aware, there are many reasons why someone would plead guilty and not necessarily be admitting that they were part of this overall or overall conspiracy.
Can I ask a factual question just to see if I'm off,
yes.
off point? Yeah, the acoustics aren't the best always.
I
guess I thought the district court might have been responding to the concern that, as I understand it, you all or the defense counsel had been able to get the evidence that all these people had pleaded guilty excluded because it might prejudice the defendants who were on trial. And so what the court thought was that you all were then going to take advantage of the fact that the jury had never heard anything about these people having pleaded guilty to then say, hey, they weren't even part of this conspiracy. And I thought the judge was just saying, well, if you're going to make that argument, that's fine, but you at least have to acknowledge that they pleaded guilty because you kept that out, and that wouldn't be fair for the jury to be misled. Am I off base on that?
I would say if you look at the plea agreements of everybody, and I've just got an example of one, ECF number 1604, but they're all the same when they go into the background of the investigation. And it starts off with, and again, there's a whole several pages that mischaracterizes the evidence. So if that came in front of the jury, the defense would have to, as bad as it was, that the jury's going to remember that Agent Sullivan said this is a DTO. The plea agreement shows, in short, it became clear that there were numerous members that came here and that the ETGC.
I'm not talking about admitting necessarily the physical plea agreements themselves. I'm just talking about, wasn't the jury kept from even learning that any of the people had pleaded guilty to count one? Just the fact of the guilty plea. I thought that's all the court was saying, is that if you all want to make this argument that they weren't part of it, you at least have to acknowledge that they actually did plead guilty. Now, you can make all sorts of arguments as to why they might have done that, why they might not really
right.
be guilty, but you're not going to just stand up there and, you know, having kept the evidence of the guilty pleas out, then be able to make this argument that would be misleading.
Well, I don't know that it's misleading. I think because those people pled to that, doesn't mean that there was an overarching conspiracy. And so while the government had spent the entire trial saying there was, using words like DTO and the hierarchy, the defense was trying to unscramble it and show the separate conspiracies and call them for what they were, saying there was no overarching, these were separate.
But you were permitted to make that argument. That exactly.
Not allowed to use the word separate conspiracies. No, not allowed to say. You could say there were members of separate, but you could not say there was no overarching because they pled to it, according to the judge and the government. Ergo, it must have existed, which completely, and even if, and I'm almost out of time here, I've got a case that directly addresses that, even if that were the case, the defense still has a right to argue their theory of the case. And I'd like to reserve, if I may.
Yeah. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm a little under the weather, so I apologize in advance. So I'm covering the jury instruction number 8 is a constructive amendment to the indictment. So we have to look at the major differences. We have to look at the indictment.
Well, I think my concern is really not so much the constructive amendment question as to whether, but really whether the district court didn't allow you to argue that there was no overall conspiracy.
They didn't allow allow the defendants to mention that there was multiple, you know, littler conspiracies. That's really what it boils down to. And jury instruction number 8 kind of gets to that point a little bit. So the major differences between the indictment and jury instruction number 8. So indictment count 2's language from ER 128 says, did knowingly and intentionally combine, conspire, confederate, and agree with each other and with other persons. Whereas jury instruction number 8 says there was agreement between two or more persons to distribute oxycodone.
And your contention is because the indictment mentions 62 people, that it's error to instruct the jury that they can find if it's just two or more, but they had to instruct the jury you had to find all 62?
Yes, because here's the thing. That's what they charged was 62.
Well, they've charged a conspiracy. They've charged a conspiracy among those 62. It doesn't mean that all of them are going to be convicted of that.
But here's the thing. When they charged it, when it came to the petite jury, that jury instruction completely changed the dynamic of what the conspiracy that was charged. So the defendants are ultimately getting convicted of a crime they weren't charged with. That's what it really boils down to. So they're getting charged with two or more people, not 62,
although in fact, you know, this cuts a little bit against the question that I've actually asked you, which is about the district court not allowing you to argue that there was no overall conspiracy. Because when the district court doesn't allow you to argue that there are small interlocking conspiracies, he's forcing the jury to decide whether there is one overall conspiracy. It may or may not have involved all 62, but it needs to involve a whole bunch of people, or you don't have an overall conspiracy.
Well, the
a little bit of a double-edged sword here.
Yeah, and the biggest limitation is on the fact that defense counsel is limited from mentioning anything about, you know, singular or multiple conspiracies.
So right. That sort of forces the government to its proof. It's going to win up or down on the question as to whether there is one overall conspiracy.
But they never said anything about they never proved an overarching conspiracy. When looking through the record, you see different things. Like, for instance, I'll give you my client, Mr. Blackman. What was proven against him is the government would go down piece by piece and say, oh, you know, like, for instance, in Sherita Horn's testimony, she would mention, oh, he had social visits with people at Flame and Joe's. Oh, you know, he was with Miss Branch, you know, and she was doing drugs with DeCarol. But at the same time, they said, oh, everyone's separate. No one's with Carmen. There didn't appear to be any taxation connection between Mr. Carmen and Mr. Blackman or Mr. Carmen and Mr. Tones. And the thing is that's how those jury instructions were misused by the government, because they didn't have to prove the overarching conspiracy because of it, and they are required to. I can tell you this, that trial counsel did argue to have the indictment put in as an exhibit to go back to the jury so that they could have a better understanding of the scope of this conspiracy, of the 62 defendant conspiracy. But ultimately, those defendants were convicted of a crime not charged by the grand jury.
So is your contention that if the judge had said, well, we've got 61 people here that you have to find, that would be a constructive amendment of the indictment?
As opposed to 62, you mean?
Right.
Yes, because
the jury would have to come back and find you not guilty, even if it could find 61? You had somebody on the list that got tossed in there, kind of got swept up, and they get dismissed early on out of the case. Everybody agrees to it.
Well, in that case, the government could have come back and superseded.
They did. It didn't. Let's suppose it doesn't happen. But at that point, you're saying that the jury would have to come back, even if it had a conspiracy among 61 people, that it would have to come back and say, well, this is otherwise a constructive amendment of the indictment. Therefore, it's you're off the hook.
It seems
sort of silly, doesn't it?
At first, yes, but I would say, you know what, the defendants have their rights to a public trial and a right to, you know, have...
Oh, nobody's going to let anybody, nobody's going to bar anybody from the courtroom.
Right, and to have basically the case proven against them beyond a reasonable doubt. So it would be the, you know, 62 defendant in that case. Otherwise, the government can supersede, you know, a little bit before trial just to change the number. I've had it in another case where... slight language just before the trial was supposed to take place in the district court on another case where slight language was changed 2 weeks in the indictment. Of course, the government gave defense counsel a heads up that language was going to change just to correct it in case there was an appeal of sorts.
But what happened? You're suggesting amendment of the indictment before trial. What happens if, you know, the indictment says 62, the evidence comes in, and as to one of them, it's pretty clear that it's just not there. But that, what happens then?
The evidence is not there for the
one. The evidence is there at least sufficient to support the conviction as to 61 of them.
Well, if the evidence is not there at trial,
as to one of them,
then in that case, that person gets dismissed.
I understand that. So. But what about the other 61?
Did the government fail to prove its case because it didn't prove all 62?
It depends on what the evidence is against all the rest of the defendants. It really does.
Well, it's enough to convict them of conspiracy, but it's a 61-person conspiracy as opposed to a 62-person conspiracy, which is what was charged initially in the indictment.
Then they could have proven it against those 61. I'd have to concede that a little bit.
Yeah, but what do we need to do with respect to any amendment to the indictment? What do we need to do with instructions?
With the instructions itself, what should have been done was that they would have to put in at least the indictment as an exhibit, which was tried and the court didn't go along with at the trial level, or they could have had the language match the indictment for jury instruction number 8, which did not happen here. The other issue I wanted to cover was the unanimity instruction. So the court improperly denied the proposed unanimity instruction as to the membership count and the duration of the conspiracy, and it was that was denied by the court. The government charged, as we know, 62 people over 2008 to 2013. Basically, the court has to look at several items. They have to look at the clarity and the presentation of the government's case, which in this case is pretty messy. When the government tried to prove the case, they changed from one line of questioning to another very quickly without finishing the thought. And I can tell you the best way to understand this case is reading how the defense counsel questioned it, because they had to unravel everything the government was talking about, and it was more streamlined and understandable. The text of the indictment could have helped understand the conspiracy a little bit, and the complexity of the case also is important to look at, because you had 5 weeks of testimony and you had hundreds of exhibits. So a jury is going to get confused here, and a unanimity instruction would have helped as to that membership and duration. I don't have too much time left, but the last couple things I wanted to cover in regards to my client was Mr. Blackman, was that I'd ask that the court in regards to his sentencing, he was incorrectly determined as a career offender for two reasons. A, first-degree kidnapping in the state of Washington should not be considered a crime of violence. Currently, right now, second-degree kidnapping is not. This court's found that. And the government, as well as the court, from looking at Mr. Blackman's sentencing record, does not show that they conducted a categorical analysis to prove that Mr. Blackman was a career offender. I had another case in the district court recently sentenced where in front of Judge Mendoza down in over in Eastern District, where they went through the entire categorical analysis, step by step by step. Here, Mr. Blackman never even got a chance to have his statement of plea guilty or sentencing with regard to the California drug crime, marijuana crime, that he was convicted of back in the 90s. And thank you, Your Honor. I want to reserve the rest of my time, even though it's 30 seconds. Thank you.
Ms. Elliott.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Suzanne Elliott, and I represent Arvin Carman. And I am going to confine my comments today to his conviction under the CCE count, because he was the only one who went to trial on that count. I will begin by stating that my issues are likely to be reviewed under the plain error standard. That is, that there's error, that it's plain, and that it affected a substantial right and seriously affected the fairness and integrity of the proceedings. My argument in terms of the unfairness and the serious effect on the verdict in this case has to do with two primary cases from this court, one being Jerome and the other being Verona. And because the government here presented evidence and argued that Carman supervised or controlled persons who, as a matter of law, were not supervised or managed by him.
And who specifically are those people?
Who he did not manage?
Who are the people that, as a matter of law, could not be deemed supervisees?
There are 62 people, and I have set them out in the brief, but I can mention two or three.
Just your two or three best.
The best, strongest. Okay. Yeah. The strongest are one of the informants who was simply a buyer-seller, Sally Guthrie, who was his romantic partner who rented a vehicle but was never involved in the overarching conspiracy, never dealt any drugs or anything. And there was a Daisy Ochoa, who was a woman who was also a romantic partner of Mr. Carman's, whose house was raided in California, but who was never in Spokane and was never managed or supervised by Mr.
And both of these plead guilty?
Did they plead guilty?
To conspiracy? Were they charged?
They were charged.
They're both charged. Okay.
Ms. Guthrie, I don't believe, pled guilty to conspiracy.
Was she convicted?
She pled guilty.
Oh, she did plead. Okay.
So but I don't believe to
Guthrie
conspiracy.
Guthrie pled guilty. Okay, what about Ochoa?
Ochoa was not charged. And Mr.
Well, if she was not charged, but she was nevertheless included on the list of people that he managed or supervised?
Yes. And then there was Brandon Werner, who was charged, but who testified he was an addict and bought drugs from Carman, so he was just a buyer.
I read Brandon Werner's testimony. I read all of it.
Yes.
And I have to say that the case for deciding that he wasn't really involved in this conspiracy is pretty thin.
Yeah.
No, I'm disagreeing. I'm disagreeing with you.
You're disagreeing with me.
I think case for saying that he's not part of the conspiracy is pretty thin.
Well, you see, I'm not arguing about the conspiracy. I'm arguing about whether or not he was managed, supervised, or organized.
All right.
By,
so you're willing to concede that he was part of the conspiracy.
Part of the conspiracy. But not everyone in the conspiracy was managed, supervised, or organized. I mean, that's the difference between obviously the CCE count.
Even though he was threatened and he felt threatened and he felt like he had to respond to things that Carman said because Carman said he was going to hurt him. And he could do it very, very quickly, and he knew that he was supposed to respond to Carman. Carman got angry when he called anybody else.
He was in a buyer-seller relationship, the law is clear.
And that's plain error?
That is plain error.
Where's the plain error?
The plain error is that that the case law is clear that buyer and seller relationships are not sufficient for supervision. And the plain error is that in Verona is there are any people in this conspiracy who were argued by the government who were not managees, supervisees, or under Carman in terms of the overarching CCE count, then you have to reverse. And
that requires us to conclude that Brandon Werner was not appropriately concluded.
Or Daisy Ochoa or Sally Guthrie, any one of the numerous persons who the government and I have listed individually and their testimony in our briefing.
Uh, I see the government's reference to Ochoa in closing argument. Did the government also argue that Guthrie was a supervisee?
Yes. So I'd like to get to that briefly as to how the government argued the supervisee. Prior to trial, there was a lot of litigation over a bill of particulars and questions about who's going to be, what's your argument going to be about all these people? And the government said it's going to be everybody. And in that particular letter, it appears to be sort of the pyramid scheme, which was, well, if Carmen supervised Michelle Reeves and she had three people under her, then, you know, all the pyramid goes up to Carmen and that's four, okay? That was the original theory. However, in closing argument and in trial, the government posited two different theories. The first one was what the government argued was, and I would pose to you that evidence is quite clear that a majority of these individuals can be traced back to Mr. Carmen and Mr. Hayes as being managed and supervised by them because, after all, it's his pill game, it's his hustle, he was the million-dollar man. This theory was that because Mr. Carmen had come up to Spokane early on and realized that he could sell pills for more on the streets of Spokane than he could in Spokane, that anyone who came after was managed or supervised or organized by him. That's just not supported by the evidence, and as we listed out and describe each of the other defendants.
Well, there was some evidence, even in the testimony of Brandon Werner, that Carmen threatened him and said, you're dealing with me, and if you're talking to other people, then you're going to get hurt.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that Mr. Carmen was supervising all of those other people.
No, you may have to have other evidence of that,
yes.
But it certainly indicates that Carmen was a big dog here.
Yes, absolutely. He had sold a lot of drugs, but that does not mean he was managing everyone who was selling drugs in a rather ubiquitous way on the streets of Spokane. I mean, the government's theory was that if you came up to if he was the first one up there and you came up after him, you were his managee, organizee, or supervisee, and that just wasn't true. In fact, there was a great deal of evidence about a schism between Mr. Carmen and Ms. Reeves and the rest of the group, and that leads to the government's other argument about why he was an organizer, manager, important person in this continuing criminal enterprise. And that was this theory of taxing. First of all, I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that anyone paid the tax. And this led to a big schism. It's described in our brief. But in closing argument, the government argued that Carmen charged or wanted to charge everyone that stepped into the selling pills in Spokane a tax. And the government then argued rhetorically, is that not managing or supervising? I can find no case anywhere in the country that says that taxing someone is equivalent to managing, organizing, or supervising them. And I can't find anything in the record that shows that anyone paid that tax. So on that theory, again, the government's theory of leading a criminal enterprise fails.
Can I just ask for a point of clarification? Your argument as to Ochoa and Guthrie is that they, as a matter of law, could not be supervisees because they had a mere buyer-seller relationship with Carmen?
Ochoa, I don't believe there's any showing she sold drugs at all. She rented that apartment in Los Angeles.
Why does that disqualify her from being a supervisee?
Because she wasn't being manager supervised as a part of this conspiracy. I think she rented an apartment and they were romantic partners. And for Ms. Guthrie, her relationship with Carmen was romantic, and she said that she rented cars for them, and until the time of the arrest, denied knowing that they were involved in drug trafficking at all. She had them hosted them at her restaurant. She let them stay at her house because she and Mr. Carmen had a romantic relationship. And she said she rented some cars for his friends. But there's no showing that she sold any drugs at all. So the problem with that theory and the finding the five supervisees, managees, and organizees, and the government's theories about that were exacerbated by the jury instruction, which then did not state correctly what the jury had to find. And that's jury instruction 7. And I agree that there was a unanimity instruction in this case, as required by Jerome, so the jury had to be unanimous as to which 5 of the other members argued by the government were man or supervisees. So we had a Jerome unanimity instruction. But the instruction failed to tell the jury that they had to be the unanimous as to the 5 persons who were supervisees. Instead, what the jury instruction said was they had to be unanimous as to 5 persons, quote, in the enterprise. Well, that's a completely different concept than being a supervisee. In the enterprise meant you had to unanimously agree that there were 5 other people who were selling drugs, who were part of the conspiracy. That jury instruction should have said you must agree on the 5 persons who were managed, organized, or supervised by Carmen. So you had the problem of both being over-inclusive, including people who, as a matter of law, could not be supervisees, and then you had the jury instruction that then expanded the universe outside of what would the government was required to prove, and simply to prove that there were 5 more people in the enterprise.
And obviously enterprise was picked up from continuing criminal enterprise, but not defined for the jury, at least as your argument is.
No, my argument is it has
to... They'll understand the word enterprise as given to them as conspiracy.
Yes, and the correct verbiage was quite simple. It should have said 5 people who were managed, supervised, or organized.
Okay, we've just taken you over time. Why don't we hear from the government, but we will give you a chance to respond.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Russ Smoot for the United States. First, I just want to say that this is a simple case with overwhelming evidence. The fact of the matter is that it's a conspiracy, it's a scheme. And before I go into the details of the conspiracy, I think we have to keep in mind when a conspiracy is committed. Conspiracy is committed when the 2 elements are met, that being that there is an existing agreement and a defendant agrees to join it. Everything else, all of the acts in a drug conspiracy that are presented as evidence are simply presented for the fact to show that that individual had an intent to join the conspiracy. So with that, why do we say it's a overarching conspiracy? It's an overarching conspiracy because this particular scheme is different than anything else that we, in our common understanding or common thought process, really look at. What happened in this case is that some individuals, well, one individual, and particularly Arvin Carmen, started distributing pills in Spokane. It was called a hustle. A hustle was defined as a business. That's how the particular... I say particular to the 8 trays in this case because that's who testified, but the hustle was their business. Illegal or not illegal, that's how they made their money. Arvin Carmen had a hustle going on in Spokane. He reached out to Gilbert Madison. Madison, in turn, connected Carmen with Miles. Madison came up. Madison sent Turner up, who was YID. Ultimately, Madison came up. Madison stayed for a while. There were others up there that were also working at the time. Testimony from Madison was that these individuals were working together. They were required to pay a tax to Carmen to come up and be involved in this scheme. As this scheme continued, the conspiracy continued, and I may be jumping around a little bit, but this conspiracy continued from its alleged beginning to its, I would say, alleged end when all were arrested. Arvin Carmen was in the very center of this thing for the entire time.
So help me understand, because it's not quite as simple, I think, as you paint it. It took a long time to try to sort through all this. But I got the impression that there might have been some early period in which Carmen was trying to enforce this taxing scheme, which apparently just did not work. It wasn't successful. And then it's really the period after that that I think most of the evidence at trial focused on, right? I can't remember the dates now. It's like 2009, 2010, whatever it is going forward until the end point. And in that period, it just seemed like it was the Wild Wild West, kind of similar to the airline example that your opponent offered. So why is that not correct? That basically everyone just saw what a thriving business Carmen had established and decided, hey, we want to get in on this action ourselves and kind of set up their own hustles.
I would say yes and no. And first, I would say it absolutely, it was described as the Wild West. The conspiracy grew. And the reason why it grew was because of the commodity. And that's where I say that this differs from perhaps the airline example, or perhaps even better, the example of car auto parts dealers that was referenced by Mr. Tones' counsel on closing. This is a commodity that has no other way but to grow. The testimony was that from Dr. Layton, which is not in here, but who testified on behalf of Mr. Chavez, that in the time period beginning in 2008, 2009, it just went exponentially and grew. It became almost an epidemic. I think that we can all understand the opioid epidemic. So what happened is it did grow. So yes, it got bigger and bigger. Second, why did the trial focus on the end time or the middle to the end? And I would say not necessarily the middle to the end, because Madison, who was there in the beginning, testified. Horn, who came in 2011, testified. And then couriers that had come up at the end testified. What we didn't get testimony from was defendants who were in the beginning, because they did not agree to cooperate.
I'm just trying to get straight in my head how the thing worked once this taxing idea came and went. Because in order for Carmen to be the head of this overarching organization afterwards, wouldn't he need to be getting a cut of everybody's sales? And it didn't seem like there was evidence that that was happening.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, and here's why. For one thing, In the matter of a conspiracy, people can come and people can go. The core members are the same as one of the factors that we have in here. So in this case, we had core members that stayed the same. Those that came in and got Carmen's permission or authorization to come in and engage in this scheme could leave the conspiracy. But that doesn't mean that they weren't part of this overarching conspiracy from the beginning, as in the Ninth Circuit in Bibero, where Bibero came in at the end of the conspiracy. He was still guilty of being a conspirator. So the fact that Carmen may not have been able to tax didn't mean that he didn't still continue to benefit from the people that were in the conspiracy. For one thing, everybody continued to benefit because of what the commodity that was being sold. People testified that they shared fades. They shared their people that they delivered to. Sometimes they didn't like to do that. Sometimes there was some competition and people stole fades, as they said. But this is a commodity to where if I sell a person one oxycodone pill today, as the testimony was, this by the addicts that were involved, this grew. That means that someone else, that I will probably sell that person two oxys next week, maybe four oxys the week after that. So what happens is that this is not a type of an organization to where there's this limited amount of money or limited amount of resources that they're going after. This continues to grow. And what happens is that they're able to feed this addiction. And therefore, if I sell to, forgive me, Your Honor, but if I sell to your customer today and I go back to Los Angeles, somebody else comes in as the customer, you're going to come back and continue to buy when I'm back in town and probably buy more. What they did is they grew the entire conspiracy or scheme because of the actual nature of what they were doing. Now, the next thing is, why is this an overarching scheme? Why is it that people could come up and kind of do their own thing, as they say, or divide into crews, or divide into franchises, or these words that were used to kind of...
I think one of the terms was independent contractors, and yes, that gives rise to concern, right? That these were independent operators doing the, they had their own hustles, and they weren't, in fact, paying a cut of their profits back to Carmen. So how is it that he was overseeing the whole operation?
It does, Your Honor, in the way that we think about that term. However, I would say that in our office, we have contractors that are not a part of the Department of Justice, but still further our mission. So that doesn't mean technically that an independent contractor doesn't further the mission of the group. Now, the
Just help me with this one question. Is it that Carmen is controlling the supply of the pills up to Spokane? Like he has a bottleneck on, so everybody who's out there distributing, is they're distributing pills that he was responsible for having sent up? Or are there multiple, you know, distribution channels up to Spokane that don't involve him?
There are multiple suppliers. Everyone, the evidence is that other people got their own plugs or their own supply. But the system that was placed in effect by Carmen and maintained by those core conspirators is different than our general conception, and here's why. As the court mentioned, that there is significance that these people that were involved in this conspiracy were 8-Trade Gangster Creek members from the same neighborhood. The purpose of this was to come up, as Madison said, was to elevate, basically to elevate 8-Trade. He became dissatisfied with with the greed that was happening because it was a purpose to elevate 8-Trade. As Horn said, the goal of this was to make money. Now, in 8-Trade, in Los Angeles, there's a structure that was testified to. It was testified to by one of the absolute highest members of that structure. They also was testified that there was a structure, that 8-Trade structure continued to Spokane, albeit somewhat differently. As Madison indicated, he was a big homie in L.A., but because Carmen initiated the pill hustle in Spokane, Carmen would be considered a big homie in Spokane in the context of this hustle, so much so that Gilbert Madison was subordinate to him when he came to Spokane. Now, that all sounds like, I hate to say it, but a bunch of words. But what's the meaning behind those words is that this structure of authority that was described somewhat as paramilitary, as soldiers and generals, translated to Spokane because it was a way of life in Los Angeles. This case dealt with individuals who testified that they had arch enemies within their neighborhood. Because they had arch enemies, which I think they said was another gang, they had to have each other's back. As Sherita Horn said, when you become a member, when she was adopted into the 8-Trades, all of a sudden the expectation was that they would, I think I'm quoting this, would back each other's play. So with this mentality, this in growing up in a violent neighborhood, testimony of that, relying on each other to back each other's play, relying on each other with this structure of authority that is followed within the gang structure, transferring that to Spokane, the same structure applied.
You keep using the word structure, and I don't understand how it translates into facts on the ground. So what I hear you saying, and really all I hear you saying actually, is that every single 8-Trade member who came to Spokane, even if they got their source of pills from somebody who had nothing to do with Carmen, if they just emulated his hustle on the ground, and none of the money they made ever made its way back to Carmen, that they were somehow part of a conspiracy that he headed. And that, to me, makes no sense whatsoever.
Because they were allowed to come up here. They had to get Carmen's authority to come up. And that's what was testified to by Madison. They had to get his authority to come up and engage in the hustle. And when they came up, he set people up in the beginning, such as Tahi Moore. He set him up, and he set Sherita Horn up, and they were then allowed to continue to do their thing. Now, that means, now, that's why I go back to, what is a conspiracy? A conspiracy is committed when the agreement to join is completed. That's it. There's not an overt act. We didn't have to prove that any number of these individuals sold pills on a certain day. It's not required. When the individuals came up, agreed to came up to sell pills in Spokane under Carmen's authority and worked with him temporarily, they could have even left the conspiracy. They can be in, they can be out. They can divide up into subgroups within that conspiracy. It is a conspiracy, and it continued. And Carmen, in many ways, was the heart of this, the center of this. Not so much as a wheel and spoke type conspiracy that we see with one person giving out pills down each spoke, but in this case, it was one person that held the authority of this wheel and spoke type situation. And the ring around that conspiracy, as is set forth in the case law, was this mentality, this structure that was expressed and testified to in trial, that Carmen had the authority and that you had to get his authorization to come up and do it. So in terms of multiple conspiracies, I wanted to indicate the question was asked whether or not how defense counsel was able to argue. And I would note that closing, the way that closing was set up for defendants, if the court recalls, was that they tried to divide up some of what they were going to argue. The defendant that's not present, Mr. Chavez, his counsel really established the multiple conspiracies argument they want, the fact that the court gave them that instruction. And what was stated in that argument was, quote, "What I'm here doing, I'm here establishing the multiple conspiracies that existed in this case." What occurred at closing was that names were placed, I think they were magnetic, if I recall, were placed on a board in different groups to quote, establish the multiple conspiracies that existed in the case, or to be able to argue that to the jury. In fact, that's in ER 4871 through 4882. So counsel was allowed, did argue that there were multiple conspiracies. Next, over objection by the United States, the district court allowed counsel for Mr. Tones to state, "We have set out the what we would put forth as a bunch of different conspiracies in this case." Mr. Tones came up here, et cetera, late in the case. Later on, counsel said, "These were the separate businesses working out there." So they did get a chance to argue their theory of the case.
Can you address on the merits why the district court was right to restrict them? Because that just struck me as an odd ruling from the court. I didn't quite understand why the court would think that they could be stopped from saying that this person wasn't a member of the conspiracy.
Well, I think Your Honor hit on it, and I had in my notes that I think the parties probably didn't articulate this as well. The defendants technically were not prohibited from saying that the other co-defendants were involved in different conspiracies, but the court said, yeah, but you have to say that they pled guilty to it. So The practical effect, as I think the parties presented, was that the defendants were prohibited from arguing that, which makes sense. They certainly would not want that to come out in closing argument. And I think the reason why the court, why that's correct, is twofold. One is that for the defendants to leave this inference, the jury instructions say that the court's not supposed to consider what other people have done in the case. So for the defendants to leave an inference that there's this question out there about, well, these people are all in different conspiracies, they must have pled to different conspiracies, they must have decided this and done something different, the court simply was saying, and I'm paraphrasing, is that you have to present the jury with the truth. You can't present them with a suggestion or a false narrative or an inference to a false narrative to say that they pled to different conspiracies without the follow-up, or that they were involved in different conspiracies without the follow-up that, yes, they pled to these conspiracies.
And so the judge wanted defense counsel in closing argument to inform the jury about a fact that no evidence had been presented on at trial? Is that that's what I'm just, I don't understand what the judge was trying to say to them.
Well, I think what the judge was trying to say to them is that if, for example, we'll take somebody that didn't plead, pled, Richard Haynes, right? Richard Haynes was an integral part in the entire operation, a core member of this conspiracy. Now, for counsel to say, well, Richard Haynes was part of a different conspiracy, then that begs the question is, well, if he was a part of a different conspiracy than this pill scheme, then it leaves a question out there that says, okay, if I believe that, then he is part of a different conspiracy and everybody's part of a different conspiracy. It takes the focus away from what's at issue. What's at issue is, one, whether the conspiracy existed, the conspiracy to distribute oxycodone pills existed, and two, whether the particular defendant on trial became a member of that conspiracy. In fact, to leave this false inference out there that somebody else may or may not have belonged to it wouldn't allow the government to say, yeah, but they all pled to it. The jury did hear from, I think, 12 people, 10 or 12 people that pled guilty to that conspiracy. And I did want to clarify, Brandon Warner was not charged. Sally Guthrie was charged, but ultimately resolved the case through a plea in state court. And Daisy Ochoa was not charged in the conspiracy. I did want to clarify that for the record for later on.
Are you going to address counsel's argument as to maybe those individuals in particular, that they, as a matter of law, could not have been deemed supervisees?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would say that the difference between Jerome and in fact Barone as well, in this case, is I'm not sending a text. I actually had forgotten the case and looked it up. Is that first, the government doesn't concede that people were presented that were not legally eligible. In Jerome, it states, and this I think this is the background of this. It is established law that the statute is satisfied with respect to the five persons organized. The person charged with the continuing criminal enterprise did not have the same kind of relationship with each of them, and the relationship did not exist at the time, and the five persons did not act in concert with each other, so long as they acted in concert with the organizer. In this case...
Well, can I ask this just as a legal matter? Does the supervisee need to know that they are, in fact, assisting in some illegal enterprise? Because your opponent's argument as to, I can't remember which one, Ochoa or Guthrie, is that that person yeah, that person might have rented some cars or let someone stay at their, but they didn't know that they were helping further a drug distribution conspiracy.
Well, I would submit that that in the context of the second question, whether or not a person is in the enterprise, and our response to that is a person can be charged in a conspiracy as an unknown other or not actually named in the conspiracy. So our position is that despite the fact that Mr. Warner was not charged, and so hence did not plead to the conspiracy, that he was still part of a co-conspirator. And then I'll move on to the others. But he was a co-conspirator because he agreed to work with Carmen. He purchased enough pills. Well, I think the record's solid on Mr. Warner.
Let me ask you this, and I'm not sure the case law is very clear on the point. Conspiracy and enterprise are, of course, different words, and they may mean different things. Is it possible that someone can be part of an enterprise without being part of the conspiracy? That is to say, can Carmen be supervising people and directing people? They've not agreed to be part of the conspiracy, but in fact they're furthering the purpose of the overall enterprise. Can they be part of the enterprise but not part of the conspiracy?
Your Honor, I will agree that it's not clear on the case law, and I would say that if the enterprise is defined by a series of continuing drug offenses, or defined by how many people are involved in that, and the one person who is, or the person that's guilty of continuing enterprise, that I don't know that a person would have to be, because since the enterprise is the distribution of oxycodone pills, and the conspiracy is basically a lesser included in that, I think that there is a connection in this case.
Well, wait,
I can't think
of an example.
Somebody
to be a supervisee would have to know, be a knowing participant in some wrongdoing, right? For example, in this case, if it had been, let's say there was some person whose only role was to book airline flights between LA and Spokane, they had no idea what the purpose of that was, but they sure did it, and it sure did further the enterprise. That person couldn't be counted as a supervisee, one of the five, could they?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Just as someone who, in many ways, has mere presence in a conspiracy but doesn't have any intent to further the agreement.
Okay, so since you conceded that, can you go back to the question
I
posed a minute ago, which is that your opponent at least argues that one of the two women, either Guthrie or Ochoa, I can't remember which one, did certain innocuous things that in the real world are not crimes in and of themselves. Yes, they did further the enterprise's goals, but that person didn't know that they were helping the enterprise. And so yet you guys argued in closing that that person could be counted as a supervisee. That's the argument. So you didn't respond yet to that.
So in terms of Ms. Guthrie, I would indicate that as the United States pointed out, that this was more than simply, we would submit as more than simply a romantic relation with Mr. Carmen. In this case, through the course of the time period of the conspiracy, Ms. Guthrie not only had people staying at her house, again, all of these can be explained in other ways, but when they start adding up, not just Mr. Carmen, but significant people in the conspiracy, Ms. Horn, Mr. Haynes, possibly Ms. Reeves. I know that Ms. Reeves was driving her car. She loaned her car out to members. She rented cars not just for Mr. Carmen, but she rented cars for other members of the conspiracy, including Mr. James and I believe Mr. Moore and possibly Mr. Shellman, but I'm only saying possibly because I that's not sticking.
Okay.
Ms. Guthrie was also, and this is to where it comes to her knowledge of the conspiracy, she was She was asked if she wanted to join the conspiracy by Carmen. Carmen indicated to her.
What did he ask her precisely? Did he say in so many words, do you want to join the conspiracy?
No.
What did he say?
No, what happened is that I believe that the testimony is that she was complaining about some bills, needing some money. Mr. Carmen offered a quote, and I'm not quoting, I shouldn't say, an opportunity to make money by basically buying into these pill deliveries, that she could put money in and she could buy into a pill delivery.
Clear that he was talking about pill deliveries in Spokane.
I don't have in front of me a quote, but I would say yes, that was the intent. I believe that Ms. Guthrie indicated that she knew what he was talking about. And so how do you show that she agreed to do that without an overt act? This is what Ms. Guthrie did. She went to the bank. She withdrew exactly $6,000, and she hid it in her wall, and she indicated that she did that for purpose of the conspiracy. Ultimately, that money was, and I'll say that money was seized because it happened at the end time of the arrest, and she indicated she was still on the fence, but the point is that she had knowledge of what this activity was about, and she continued to assist. At the time, even at that time, she had rented a car for Mr. Carmen.
What about Ochoa?
Ochoa was one of, the best way to describe it, as it was described, one of Mr. Carmen's many romantic connections. Ms. Ochoa was not on the rental for the apartment that was in on Acacia in Glendale, California. Ms. Reeves was actually the renter of that apartment, as she was the renter of the one in Spokane. Ms. Ochoa, however, was signed up for all of the utilities, to pay the utilities on that apartment. Within that apartment, when it was searched, there was pills that were found, firearms that were found. Now, the question then becomes, did Ms. Ochoa know what was going on when she was facilitating this place? Well, evidence was submitted from social media evidence that had Ms. Ochoa with piles of money relevant to the conspiracy, and I would argue that while, like any defendant, we can't say, what did you know, what did you mean? This is the type of evidence that would indicate to a jury, that she knew what was going on. She was on the utility. She lived in the house. There were pills there. She was doing the same things that other romantic relationships were in the case, such as Reeves.
Did you have evidence that either Guthrie or Ochoa were members of the Eight Trays?
No. Guthrie definitely was not. I don't believe Ochoa was. But so ultimately, I think what it comes down to is these individuals were presented to the jury amongst others. They had a connection. They had a connection to Carmen. They didn't necessarily have a connection to everybody else, which, again, the United States, I'm sorry, I'm over. I think there was enough to be presented to the jury for the jury to find them to be supervisees.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, we've got three of you who had each sought to preserve time. You preserved various amounts or not preserved various amounts. Why don't we start out with each of you getting 2 minutes, and we'll just see what happens. We do not want to cut you off. So say what you need to say.
I only have a few points to make. In answer to the court's question about the guilty plea issue in closing argument and not being able to argue that the others were part of separate conspiracies and not over the overarching. The fact that the other defendants pled guilty meant that they waived that defense, but the appellants here went to trial and they didn't waive. They have a right to that defense, and not being able to argue that took that constitutional right away from them.
And not to be able to argue that, were they, as a practical matter, not being able to argue with that, or as a legal matter, meaning if they argued that they had to fess up to the fact that everybody else had pled, I mean, what do you mean when they're not able to argue it?
They weren't able to argue it in that The judge said, obviously there was the quid pro quo. You say this, then this is coming in.
You can say it, but it'll cost you.
It'll cost you. And it hamstrung them because that can leave the...
Why is that an illegitimate price for the judge to exact? Because what he's saying, it'll cost you, I mean, it's true.
That they pled guilty, right, but not necessarily...
And you could say, and people plead for different reasons.
Right. But then, as the court pointed out, none of that evidence had come in to the court before, to the jury during the trial. That was all going to be coming up for the first time at closing. That also, I would say, increases the defendant's burden, because now you have to explain why these people pled to this, and they really were part of a separate conspiracy. And you've got 50 plea agreements. There's no way the jury's going to take the defense counsel's word for that. And the jury can be left the way they were forced to argue it. The jury can easily been left with the impression that you can have multiple conspiracies at the same time you have this overarching conspiracy, but these multiple conspiracies are just part of it, because other jury instructions had said you can have subgroups, et cetera. So that was easily a cause for jury confusion. Also, to the government's point that all the individuals had to, all the ETGs had to have Carmen's permission to come to Spokane. There's clearly nothing in the record to support that, other than Madison saying that for him, he needed Carmen's permission, and that was back in 2009, I believe. And then the last point is simply that the government seems to be conflating the structure of the ETGs in L.A. With a structure associated with a drug trafficking organization that just didn't exist in Spokane. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Drayers.
Your Honors, just wanted to make a quick mention that there was no, the government did not mention any business connection between Mr. Carmen and Mr. Blackman when they were up here, or a business connection between Mr. Carmen and Mr. Tones either. Mr. Blackman did not further any mission for an overarching conspiracy. He was out for himself, clearly, from the record. And in regards to what the government said, that they had each other's backs, like, you know, the conspiracy had each other's backs, it's clear in the record that from the testimony that Mr. Carmen thought Mr. Blackman was a snitch. I mean, if someone thinks you're a snitch, you're not going to want to work with them, and vice versa. I mean, that creates a very huge conflict in terms of personalities. And to jump off of the authority to come up issue, Mr. Blackman, that's not in the record. Mr. Blackman has actually been up in Spokane since at least before 2004, because 2004 was when he got his kidnapping conviction in Washington State Court. So it doesn't make any sense, Your Honors. Does the court have any other questions for me at this time?
Okay,
thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Elliott.
Thank you. Just briefly, I appreciate the government's clarification about Ms. Guthrie, but she got a diversion in federal court. I commend the court to the government's witness, Ms. Horn, who testified that Guthrie had no involvement in distributing pills. That's ER 1772. There was a discussion right before the arrest warrants came down between Mr. Carmen and Ms. Guthrie, and she did take some money out of her account, but she consulted with her children, and her children told her that she should have nothing more to do with Mr. Carmen, and so she did not give him any money. Her testimony is at ER 3520 to 3540 or so, and it's clear that she denied any involvement in the conspiracy at all. There was no showing that Ms. Ochoa took any direction at all from Mr. Carmen or Ms. Reeves. The fact that she was pictured with money and paid for some utilities is unconnected to this conspiracy or to any supervision. Finally, and we do go on at length in the brief about it, but again, Alex James, according to the government's witness, Mr. Madison, Alex James never worked with Carmen. That's ER 1001. He had his own business. So in order to convince the jury that all of these persons were Carmen's supervisees, they had to rely on two theories that simply weren't sufficient, and that was the taxing theory and the they all learned this model from Carmen theory. Neither one was sufficient to prove that all of the persons argued to the jury were supervisees, organizers, or managed by Carmen. So we would ask the court to reverse the CCE conviction for Mr. Carmen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank everyone for useful arguments. United States versus Tones, Blackman, Carmen submitted for decision. That's the end of argument for this morning.